Well, I'm going to try to do this without the mic so I can move the slides forward. So hopefully, can everybody hear me all right?
Yeah.
All right, good. Well, you can't see me. That's better, I guess. I'm Brent Jones. I've been with ESRI about 4 years. I came from working in private practice for a firm that did photogrammetry, a lot of parcel conversion, civil engineering, and actually built GIS systems. So I've been about 20 years outside of ESRI, worked with a lot of ESRI technology. And been there. I think I moved farther in continental United States than anybody I know. ESRI, as you know, is, maybe you don't know, it's in Redlands, about an hour and 15 minutes east of here. I always get the directions backwards because I'm from a town about the size of Redlands, about 2 hours to the border and an hour and a half to the ocean. It just happens to be Bangor, Maine, so it's a little bit of a switch. For those of you who don't know a lot about ESRI, it's 40 years old. It's younger than me. It's a financially stable company. It's the second largest privately held software company in the country. We've been around quite a while. Hopefully most of you know a bit about us. We really have three goals, and those goals have remained unchanged for the past 40 years. For advancing geography and geographic science, and that's actually what created GIS. When ESRI was created, GIS didn't even exist. And to work with spatial thinking, and maybe we can make some better decisions if we use a lot of spatial thinking in our decisions. And it's supporting employees. That's kind of a funny one. It's a really different place to work. It's kind of like the world's largest mom and pop operation. You know, if you have a real problem, you go talk to the owner of the company, no matter what your level. To get things started here, GIS, we have an hour here, okay? So if you have any questions through any of this, please raise your hand. I've tried to segment this into three separate areas of presentation. I'm going to try to pull it all together at the end, hopefully. GIS is really a bunch of hardware, software, and data to manage, analyze, and disseminate. It's really a focused idea of managing data in a central environment using different types of interoperability. We think of interoperability like the web and internet protocol and these kind of files transfer things. That's what we think of interoperability. But really, there's another kind of interoperability, and that has to do with geography, where things are. So we can kind of use where things are and how they relate to each other. It's really important as we talk about cadastre and parcel management. So GIS uses a really rich data model. This idea of a data model, you know, we know a lot of things in our head. And when we do our work, all of the knowledge that we collect, we use when we do our work. Well, we try to abstract some of that knowledge and model it in a database so other people who use some of our work, and we know our work gets misused all the time, so people who use some of our work can understand through the way data is displayed and handed to them, so they don't make the mistakes that we don't want them to make. So GIS organizes and manages geographic knowledge in six basic types. Well, it's the data itself. It's raster data, vector data, survey data, points, lines, polygons. I was giving this talk, and one thing really tricky with GIS is the language. Right, I was giving this talk in Ventura County, a little bit different. I do a lot of work with surveyors. Any of you guys surveyors? All right, good. I can get away with a lot now. Surveyors and GIS, you know, there's a little tension there sometimes. And I was asking these surveyors, I was saying, do you know what geography is? And a guy said, yeah, it's a class in 10th grade. And I said, what about geometry? And he said, same thing. Well, those words, geography and geometry, have really special meaning in GIS. You know, GIS kind of grew up on the Galapagos Islands. It has its own language. So if you come in from the outside, which I did, you don't really have a full understanding of all those meanings. So we try to, you know, like geoprocessing, that's another one. That's just a big word for doing cool stuff with geographic data. For example, you know, putting an address in and putting a point on a map. That's a geocode. That's a geoprocess. But, you know, GIS, that's a really key function, doing a buffer, for example, you know, getting all the addresses of you know, within 500 feet of a home. You know, that's a geoprocess. So that's just kind of a big word for, you know, doing complex things. And really, in the database, that is complex, although it seems pretty easy to us. This notion of data models, I mentioned that briefly, that's really important because we can begin to pull all the things that we know. And way towards the end of this presentation, there's one particular example that I think as mappers you'll all appreciate. And there's new workflows. So in GIS, this idea of a workflow is how do we logically go through our work to make the best decisions with the best data possible? You know, there's many ways to do things. What's the best way? How do we automate some of those things? And metadata, does everybody know what metadata is? Data about the data. That's all it is. Yeah, it's a fancy word. I was in Ethiopia a couple weeks ago, and I drank a Meta beer, man, and I had to save the bottle, so I got that bottle. It's not like it's appropriate to have on my desk, but the and I will talk a little bit about that too. What you guys do is totally taken for granted in the United States. It's just part of the fabric of what we do and how we live. Less than a third of the world has the benefit from the kind of work that you do, and hopefully I can make that point as we go through this presentation. And then the last is maps and visualization. And this idea of maps and visualization, sometimes that's the output, sometimes that's the input. So it's almost a circular thing. So summarize it real quick. Visualization, data management, spatial analysis, and the mobility of that data. Can you get data to and from places where you need to do your work? Sometimes that's a field. Sometimes that's another office. Sometimes that's your home computer. But, you know, that's really the core function of what GIS is. Well, I mentioned this idea of maps and data information knowledge. It's kind of a continuum. You'll get a survey map, and you're going to pull information off of that map. And you're going to put that information somewhere where it can be used for other things. Modeled properly, we can take that information and create knowledge. And once we kind of embed that into a system, then we can actually make new maps. It kind of goes round and round. So, you know, maps can be used for data input, and they can be used for ways to communicate knowledge and other information. But this continuum, this is really kind of important because it's the fundamental way that we get data to do meaningful things with. Almost all of our data comes from some kind of location. There's estimates out there. I think it's 85% of all data that exists has a geographic component. You know, I don't know if that's true. It sounds about right. You know, the only thing I think it doesn't have a geographic component is like financial stuff. I mean, there's a where part to money. You know, it's not in my pockets, you know, but I don't know. But, you know, so money might not have a where. But almost every data, as we think about it, there's a where component. It's very difficult to manage that data in a database. And it's done with special databases called geodatabases. And inside the geodatabase, you have everything has an attribute. An attribute is just what we know about it. Fire hydrants are a great example because we can all look at them. Fire hydrants have a manufacturer date, they have an installation date, they have a maintenance schedule. Maybe you turn them right to shut them off, maybe you turn them left to shut them off. You know, they have certain types of fittings for certain types of hoses. You know, maybe there's a thrust block. You know, there's all these attributes about fire hydrants that some people care about, some people don't care about. The insurance company cares about how far is that fire hydrant from your house for your insurance rates. So those attributes, you know, we think of the attributes of the things we use. It's more, you know, as we move to enterprise systems, we have to think about the attributes that everybody uses with our data. This is going to be a real challenge in the coming years as we begin to remove the silos in local government. I'm going to talk quite a bit about that. Data also has geometry. It's a point, line, or polygon. I mean, it's a fancy word, class of 10th grade, but, you know, how is that, you know, where is that, and how is that represented? What do we know about how that's connected to other things? And the behavior. This is a really important part. This distinguishes GIS from just any other kind of computer graphics. That, let's say we want to route an ambulance, and we want the ambulance to go to your house, and it's going down the highway here. Well, you know, it can't get off on every single street. Streets are just lines, right? Well, they're really not just lines. You know, maybe those streets don't intersect. Maybe, like yesterday, when we know that there's a bit of a drizzle, which I can't believe that, you know, California calls this rain. It's unbelievable. We've got 2 days of rain. Oh, it's so gloomy. You know, this kind of storm where I'm from, it takes an ice storm with like a half an inch of glare ice to cause that kind of traffic jam. You know what I mean? Unbelievable. But, you know, we know different times of day when traffic is different, right? We know those patterns. Well, why would we route an ambulance during what may appear to be the fastest route when we know it's not the fastest route during certain times of the day? That's behavior that we model in the database. Again, we're taking information that we know in our heads, information in other sources, modeling that to make the most intelligent decisions. So what happens is, as we do this, GIS becomes the platform. We have all these, you know, we think of GIS as like, you know, this desktop thing that we just do stuff with. It's not really, yeah, that's one function. The desktop is a very important function, but really it's the platform for managing all data that has a geographic component. It really is the framework that provides all the analytical capabilities and visualization capabilities. So now let's move into, you know, kind of where we reside in this technology. Well, cadastre is a component of land administration. Land administration is kind of this big umbrella. Actually, we've got a great book coming out on land administration. Should be in print next month. Hopefully, these things are kind of complicated to get books through our processes internally at ESRI. But we've got a really nice land administration book that would complement a lot. We also have a new map use book. Has anybody seen the new map use book? It's an update from like a 15-year-old book. It's not a bad book either. But in land administration, we have cadastre, we have land registration, the registry of deeds. Those are different, you know, the county registry. Those are different in different parts of the country. Interestingly enough, Ireland, we have, what, 3,300 counties or something like that. It's done differently in every county. This is almost like working in the rest of the world put together, trying to work in the United States with our property registration systems. Just kind of a side note, this is kind of a fun fact. Does anybody know why we have title insurance? Go ahead.
Because there are many different ways of describing the last and they are just going to ensure that you're actually buying what you can buy.
That's pretty good. But it's actually because of a cap. No joke. In 1900, 1850s, we had the most modern land system in the world. You know, and we owe it all to Thomas Jefferson. What a brilliant guy. If you guys don't read Thomas Jefferson, you need to pick up some of this stuff. He's the father of our whole land system. Well, what happened in Chicago, some cow kicks over a lantern, causes the Chicago fire, burns down the Cook County Courthouse. And at that moment, when all the records were gone, a couple attorneys sat around and said, "What the hell are we going to do?" One guy says, "I think we can make some money on this." Bang. Overnight came Chicago Title, and at that point, our land registration system stopped. It stopped maturing. The old professor, my great guy, he's writing a book, and he wanted to call it, his working title is Arrested Cadastral Development. Because we had this massive system moving forward up until the Chicago fire, and we're all about speed and reducing risk. Well, most of the developed world has what's called Torrens Title or something related to Torrens Title, where the government guarantees title. We don't have time for that in the United States. We just ensure it and keep moving on. But it's a really important part of how all these little pieces fit together. Valuation is a big component. Nobody likes taxes. There's only one reason we tolerate taxes, and that's because we believe them to be fair and equitable. And that has to do with the transparency of our systems, where you can go look at your neighbor's taxes and you can look at your taxes, and plus you have the right of appeal. And actually, this area of transparency is really growing and is going to become more critical as government becomes more complex. The planning, land management, those are other components of land administration, but we're not going to talk about those. We're going to try to stick to the cadastre and to parcels. So we have the centralized data management. This is really an important concept because other people are using the data that we create and manage. They may have different uses. They may need different things than we traditionally have managed. So it's really important to keep that in the back of our minds. Imagery is kind of we think it's awesome, don't we? Imagery is like GPS. It takes no prisoners. You know, what happens with imagery is you pull up a really precise ortho that's current, and your maps don't overlap. You go out with GPS and you locate some points, and they don't fit on your map. These things are exposing a lot of problems. They're exposing a lot of more to-dos in the work we do. But with imagery, it's going to actually, over the next 3 or 4 years, change the way a lot of you do your work. With automatic change detection, you can say, just show me the new pools. You know, show me where there's anything that's changed, so I don't have to go look for this, and I don't have to send people out in the field. You know, pictometry, any of you guys use pictometry? That's some wild stuff, you know? That's really reducing the cost of sending people back into the field, because it gives you not just an ortho or straight down planimetric view, it gives you kind of a view all the way around the building. And you can overlay your information even in an oblique view. Something else we're seeing happening now is integrating the valuation systems with GIS. Shockingly, most valuation systems don't use much geospatial capabilities to really understand the value of property. They've got little algorithms and it's built in. They don't use this whole idea of geography. And it's in the next few years, you're going to see a lot of movement here too, particularly in the QAQC. We met with IAAO maybe 3 weeks ago, and you know, trying to figure out what are the biggest challenges of assessors, and you know, and how do we work with the CAMA companies to help them integrate some technology. And one guy said, "Well, here's the problem." He said, "I want to know about the problems before they're problems. Reduce appeals, and then I want to get a visual of the data before it goes out. Just kind of like what changed more than X percent. You know, what doesn't make sense?" And he told a story about looking at one tax district and seeing that the revenues were several million dollars more 1 year to the prior year, and he couldn't figure out what was going on. And once he figured it out, the tax bills were on the loading dock, and a couple properties that had tax bills, instead of $10,000, they were $1 million. So, you know, you kind of want to find those before they happen. They literally on the loading dock, pulling out the mail to get those letters before they went out. Imagine the problem that created. Well, there's specialized workflows now used in processing data. I put this slide in just because it is in this idea of the things that are happening with GIS, but later on I'm going to spend some detailed time trying to help you understand how this is really going to change very significantly in the future. So we got some traditional uses of GIS in government. You know, we use it for scenario planning. You know, you blow something up, and then I think we got one of those going on like right now, right? The big earthquake drill that's happening this week or something. You know, GIS is all over that. You know, for planning fires. Actually, by the way, in fire control, parcels are incredibly important, and they're used by everybody. We're going to talk about that too, but they don't necessarily always have access to them, and they don't always necessarily need all the attribute information that comes with them. But GIS is used for all kinds of activities in government. But we think about the GIS, the public works or the police department's GIS, and we think about, you know, oh, the health department's GIS, or, you know, that's land records over there. We don't think about these things all together, and that is really one of the big areas that we see changing. We can't really afford to maintain duplicate copies of data. And we really do, you know, it's not like same, you know, everybody says playing on the same sheet of music. Well, everybody's going to have their own music. They at least have to be in the right key, you know, and play your own instrument. It's really a different way to think about when we go to the enterprise of using data and creating data. But the new rules for government that we see happening now is this notion of transparency. This is really important. Anybody been to recovery.gov? Jot that down. That is the future of where transparency in government is going. You can get on recovery.gov and you can find every stimulus package contract that was let, who let, how much it's for, and all the contracts that particular firm has. We're just beginning to break the, just scratch the surface of what's going to happen with transparency. You know, we all put our parcels up. That's kind of cool, right? Does everybody have their parcels online? I'm not going to ask who doesn't. That's too painful. But just the notion of having that data online reduces the amount of people coming to your office and asking for information and asking for maps. Huge benefit if you're not doing it. But it's a level of transparency. It's a level of getting information to the citizens so there's not this feeling of hidden information. The citizen participation, some call this, is a piece of Gov 2.0. Some people say a lot of Web 2.0. You know, when people pull up that current image with their house, and they can see exactly how they're being mapped in the municipality, that's really pretty powerful. It takes away a lot of fears. And if there's a pothole, or maybe there's some repair that needs to be done in front of their house, well, they can just plop that in and say, hey, you know, there's a dead cat here. Would you come pick it up? Actually, to tell you the truth, anybody here from L.A. County? All right, well, you know, L.A. County's got this thing. I can't remember what they call it. It's a dead dog application or something like that. But you can route vehicles in the most efficient manner using GIS, right? You know, so like FedEx, UPS, all those guys use this technology for minimizing the driving. Sears, you know the GPS? You see their vans with the GPS on the top of their vans? They saved $42 million the first year by putting those GPS in their vans. Because, you know, it takes like an hour to install a dishwasher, half an hour to remove and install a new washing machine. You know, so they have all these repairmen with all these different things delivering, and they all have different times. So they can put all that information into a system, optimize the routes. You know, who's called the cable company and said, we're going to be at your house somewhere between 11 and 5. What the hell is that? You know what I mean? Okay, well, maybe I'll be there between 11 and 5. Maybe I won't, you know? It's like waiting at the doctor's office. Come on, you can predict a little bit better than that. Hint to Heloise right here. Take the first appointment of the day. Been doing it for 10 years. You're never late, right? They're always on time for you. But this idea of routing vehicles with this kind of data, well, in L.A. County, they do that to pick up dead dogs. So, you know, so people are calling in the citizen participation saying, you know, those things are health hazards, you know? So put these in, and it routes actually in real time, you know, the vehicles to go pick those up. Web portals, we're not going to talk a lot about that, but on the bottom and on the right, those are new views of data where it's not like looking at a desktop anymore. You can get access to data in the database, get metrics on the data, get graphs and analysis. Because in GIS, there's no graphics file. Okay, the graphics are rendered out of the database. So they just, you know, it looks like there's graphics there, but it's like a bunch of attributes in the database that tell you how to draw it. Well, that's pretty important because then we can do all kinds of other things with that data because it's properly modeled in the database. And one of those is put those nice graphs up on web pages. This idea of a dashboard, this is also really important. What this does, this gives the user the view of what they deem most important to them. So you can build a dashboard that says, maybe I want to know where my field crews are, maybe I want to know the status of my backlog, you know, things like that. You can build that for, you know, what concerns you all the time. Build a dashboard, look at that view, and as people maintain their data, you can see in real time the things that are interesting to you or you're concerned with. Census. That's huge. The amount of data being collected on this census, actually they're using all GIS to collect data. They're getting a lot of positions on data. In some of the more rural areas, they're getting point positions on driveways. So you know where to route an emergency vehicle. You know, the address where the mail goes is not necessarily where you want that vehicle to go. The mailbox and the driveway. And where the house is, these are all different things. I worked on a project in West Virginia, and believe me, West Virginia lives totally up to its reputation. Okay, and I actually learned that the the rules of thumb when, you know, being a surveyor in Maine, you know, you find all kinds of things, you know. I mean, you hack your machete into a hornet's nest, you know, you can come across somebody's pot patch. I guess you can do that out here too. But you come across all kind of funny things when you're out in the boondocks. Well, in West Virginia, you can come across stilts that are running. So if this ever happens to you, here's another hint from Heloise. The rule is you pick up a small stick of wood, not like a twig, but a small stick, not too big either, and you put it on the still and just keep walking. That kind of makes you an accomplice in a way, but it kind of tells the guy, because if the still's running, they're there watching it. It kind of tells them that you're cool with this and you're not going to turn them in, so that's it, in case it ever comes across you. But what we did in West Virginia, really, really rural, you know, we couldn't, it's really difficult to know where the mail goes to where that house is. It's really tough. It's a real big GIS problem. You know, the rural route mails and all that stuff, right? Well, what we did was we mailed everybody a card with a unique number on it. We said, put this up in the window of your trailer, right? And then somebody could come by, take a picture of that card, get a GPS coordinate, and it tied the whole thing together. So the census is involved in a little bit of that stuff. There's some issues with the census because they can't share a lot of information, which is really too bad, because they really do have a lot of really good information that we could use and still protect privacy. Demographics, this is a real new area. You know, you can get on ESRI's website if you want. You know, Tim can send you the link to this if you want. It's pretty cool. Put in your zip code and it tells you about your town. I mean, average income, buying patterns, who's likely to, you know, buy a sedan versus a minivan, who's likely to vacation in Disneyland versus Six Flags, really those kind of demographics at that detail. And for Starbucks, you know, this is really important stuff, because they get down to the small neighborhood with this data. It's really important because, you know, you'll drive 4 or 5 minutes to a Starbucks, you're not going to drive a half an hour, right? The average American male will drive 5 hours to a Bass Pro Shop. Right? So you don't want to be putting the Bass Pro Shops where you're putting the Starbucks, right? So you want to know where the people are, what their profile is, you know, to do that kind of, and that kind of data. You know, now that things are digital, you do it once and it grows. It's not like you have to maintain these things. The foundation data, the address of that house doesn't change. The general character of the neighborhood changes relatively slowly. You keep that data up to date, it accumulates, it becomes really incredibly valuable. So this idea, I just want to make sure we get this idea of enterprise GIS in a government. It's all these functions happening on a centralized database. Now, that doesn't mean everybody uses GIS. We all have to do our work, whether it's in AutoCAD or it's on a mobile application, or you know maybe you're even using a little bit of Google Earth, which, I don't know, anybody use Google Earth? I mean, it's kind of cool for fun. You know, when the rubber meets the road, it's not really where, you know, I don't know if I'd trust it, but it's got, you know, I like checking out the Great Wall, flying around the world, it's kind of cool. But in GIS, we can capture data from many, many, many environments, store that in a structured database, disseminate that. This bottom line is enterprise bus, if you can't see that in the back of the room. Hopefully, am I blocking anybody? Can you see all right?
Not through you. No.
Not through me? Should I stand over here?
I could do the shoot. Sorry about that.
Should have been doing that earlier. Let's go over here. Is that better? Sorry, really apologize for that. The line on the bottom, the enterprise bus, that's services oriented architecture. Go back now on that stuff. Okay. So that's a really important term because it's kind of it's like a gas pipeline. A gas pipeline is like a long, skinny aerosol can, and they pump gas into it, and they keep it pressurized, and you can tap into that gas line anywhere along the way and pull gas out, or you can put gas in. Well, an enterprise service bus is the same thing with data. You can push data in, you can pull data out. You can pull out what you want, you can put in what you want. You don't have to share everything. But for example, parcels, you can maintain parcels, put those on a bus. People can use those, they can't edit them or change them. Maybe you want to edit them, change them, maybe you want them to add certain attributes that you don't want to maintain, you want them to maintain that. So it's a really rapidly maturing technology that enables this whole idea of data sharing. So this is the, has everyone seen the Gartner Hype Cycle? All right, this is a really cool way to think about technology. On the left is the, on that upward slope, that's the technology trigger. Okay, that's where an idea comes up. And then everybody gets real pumped up. It's gonna be greater than sliced bread. That's where it hits the top. And then we find out it really doesn't do anything what we thought it was gonna do. It falls down into this trough of disillusionment. And then it is, you know, there are uses to the technology, we're not really sure what they are, and then we kind of grow out of that into the slope of enlightenment, and then finally we hit the plateau of productivity. Think about GPS when it first hit the market. 1983, 3 o'clock in the morning, car batteries, boxes this big, you know, shaky satellites trying to get a good position. Look at it now. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but if you don't have like two or three GISs, man, you're missing the boat. This is the coolest thing on earth. In Maine, we judge manhood by two-stroke engines. Right? Snowmobile, snowblower, chainsaws, outboards, four-wheelers, that kind of stuff, right? I think the new judge is how many GPSs you have. All right? The interestingly enough, Nokia owns or licenses all the patents to make your phone good to 10 centimeters. That's unbelievable. Worldwide, 10 centimeters. To them, it's just about business of when and if they do it. It has nothing to do with the technology. This is a cool way to look at technology. Look at SO over there on the right. Okay, this is 2008. This is 2009 right here. You can circle it here. SO passed location aware applications. So it is moving really quickly as being the standard technology for running enterprise systems. A couple other things there just that are kind of interesting. Wikis are moving up. I actually saw a wiki in Massachusetts for deeds. It was a deed wiki. So you could put in any information that you knew about, like the boundaries of your parcel, who used to own it, you know, kind of information like that. It's really, you know, if you collected that, you know, over time, that's really, really quite valuable stuff. The electronic paper, anybody use a Kindle? Oh man, that's the coolest thing on earth too. I don't carry any books anymore. I don't carry any magazines. I don't carry anything but this Kindle. Put in PDFs, scan anything I want to read, and read it on the Kindle. I do a lot of traveling. I started out as a surveyor, and I used to describe to people, you know, what surveying was like. So, well, it's like lugging stuff through the woods. It's really what it was like surveying in Maine. Now I just lug stuff through airports. So I try to minimize what I carry, but the Kindle's pretty cool if you're not into it. It's worth checking out. Okay, why are parcels a big deal? Anybody know who this guy is? I'm not gonna question this thing. But see that URL at the bottom? Jot that down. That's if you go to userite.com events and hit the user conference plenary, and you can get it's a 38-minute video from this guy. You can saw him before he got the Nobel Prize because he's going to get it. His name is Hernando de Soto. He's a Peruvian. Wrote this book, The Mystery of Capital. And what he theorizes and presents is the reason democracy works in the West and fails everywhere else in the world is because of our property system. That we have the ability to represent property in paper. So we have deeds, and we have mortgages, and we have these things, these rights and restrictions of our property that we record. They're transparent. We can insure them. So nobody's going to kick us off our property because we've demonstrated ownership. We also have, that also works with copyright, that works with intellectual property, like movie rights, things like that. We can represent all those things in paper and create markets with that paper. So what happens is now the capital in all the real estate is what fuels the economy. All the value, all the property is available to run the economy. This is available. This is only available in less than a third of the world. We have a lot of work going on all around the world to try to build these systems. So it's stability. You know, Larry Summers, he was the president of Harvard, right? He's on Obama's economic team. He said, nobody ever washed a rented car. All right? Think about that. You know, think about renting versus ownership. You know, you treat property different. You can accumulate wealth. You can, you know, you can give it to your kids. You can sell it. There's a lot of things that can happen with it, and that is that's available to less than a third of the world. But that's his theory. Highly recommend that video. I've watched it 4 or 5 times. It's fabulous. And if you're really into it, you can read the book. So what is a parcel? Anybody seen that new National Land Parcel Data book? Came out like 2 years ago. There's a drive by the feds to have a national parcel data set. The feds own them. Their idea is to have the locals do all the work and then they just take it and use it, kind of way it works. But you know, these parcels have good definitions. They're really important. I think it's a little bit different to everybody else, but this is how they're defined in that book. When you look at a map, you look at that parcel, man, you go to your house. You know, I did a mapping project for Providence Gas 15 years ago. Big ortho project. And so we did the orthos, and then we captured the planimetrics on top of that. And, you know, got off to a rough start, but we got it on track. You know, we're running on all 12 cylinders. Things are going great. And president of the company, president of Providence Gas, comes in, you know, during a project review meeting, you know, wants a status update. Well, what do? You go look for your house when you see a map, right? We missed mapping it. We missed it. You know, it was like, it was like such a tragedy. But it shows that when you're a homeowner, that's what everybody goes to their house. So they don't know much about GIS, so we have to build systems for them so they know what that parcel is good for. Is it good for building the fence? Not a very expensive fence if it were made. Right, you know is it good for taxation? Is it good for locating a utility pole when you want to put a utility pole right between two properties? What's that parcel good for? I don't think the average homeowner knows when they see parcels online what they're really good for. I think that's kind of responsibility of our community, responsibility of the survey community to try to figure out how to get that word out there. Surveyors, parcels drive them nuts. Because that's, you know, they do. Surveyors work like on an individual parcel basis. And that thing is accurate. It's crazy in that little spot. But it's not like what we're trying to do. Trying to make the best representation of parcels across the whole community. This enterprise professional users, this is where the rubber's going to hit the road in the coming few years. When we maintain parcels and they're used by somebody else, and they demand a different accuracy, we're going to have to live up to their demands if we want to continue to be the stewards of that data. Otherwise, they're going to maintain duplicate data sets, or they're going to be the stewards of that data. It's really important to think of the downstream uses of all data if you're going to maintain the stewardship of that data. That's a roadblock for building a lot of efficiencies in the local government. So a lot of people have different ideas of, you know, what's on parcels. This is kind of just, you know, a short list of the limitations of what we see. There's more than this, but they're kind of a representation of the limits of rights. Who uses them in local government? I think it's a pretty exhaustive list here. I'm sure I'm missing somebody. But everybody uses them. And think about what they use them for. They all need something different. The environmental guys need something different than the county engineer. The planner needs something different than the guy who's doing permits. So when we maintain parcels, we don't need to maintain all the attributes. We need to think about what geometry everybody needs into the workflows that we work with. So outside, you know, our local government, who uses them in the community? You'd be surprised. A lot of people use them. You know, they're using. You know, they used to call before you dig. Historians use these things as well. You know, kind of a niche kind of use. One of the areas I think is going to be a big use for parcels is going to be renewable energy. That's going to be a real big thing. I think it's being pushed by the feds. So the feds use it for all kinds of stuff. We did a bunch of work on Katrina. And much like 9/11, we did a lot of work on 9/11 and very similar. In the trade towers was the emergency response center. All the data was wiped out, all the GIS data. So fortunately, there was a copy of the data at Hunter College we could use. We didn't have that same luck in Katrina. This is no joke, what happened here. So everything's wiped out. Where is the data? We had guys on canoes in the sheriff's office trying to get into a cage to get a government worker's PC out. The PC was impounded, had it all the data on, but it was impounded for child porn charges. Okay? But that was the only computer that had the data on. So one of the drawbacks of relying on these systems is you gotta have redundant copies somewhere else. You gotta have them, Iron Mountain or something like that. Feds have a huge interest in Parsons. Huge interest for emergency response in FEMA. Actually, I think that anybody here work State Department of Revenue? It's kind of interesting. You hear these budget gaps and stuff like that, and those are just wild guesses. That's all they are. They're not very close. They may be close, but they're not based on a lot of information. Like, can you say what the assessment is going to be, in your districts in 2 years? I don't think so. We can't predict that stuff. All we can do is take the data as it comes in and do the best analysis that we do. So states are really getting interested in this. They're interested in equitable assessment from community to community as well. They're interested in their own property. They're interested in our municipalities managing property off the tax rolls appropriately. Should property that's publicly owned be put on the tax rolls? There's a lot of concern here by states. So this is not an exhaustive list, but this is where audience participation comes in. Why don't you want to share Parsons? Most don't. Some do. There's a couple cases here in California that made it to the Supreme Court. At least one made it to the Supreme Court, the one in Santa Clara County. You guys all familiar with that Santa Clara County case? Pretty interesting case. They were sued. They wanted $100,000 for their parcels with all the attribute information, and Freedom of Information Act. And there's some special laws here in California about access to public information that you can only charge. It's created with tax dollars. You only charge the cost of reproduction. Well, just a month or two ago, it was settled in Santa Clara County. Now you buy their parcel map for like $3. So but we put a lot of cost into building these maps, right? So we don't really just want to like share it. There's a liability. What if the data's wrong? You coming back to somebody? What will you want next? That's always kind of scary. What do I get in return? What are you going to barter with me for? It's hard to manage these expectations. Which data model are you using? How current does this need to be? What's the quality of this? So any other concerns of why you wouldn't want to share your parcels with the state feds? Sure.
A lot of the counties have counted on the revenue from selling from the states to maintain the systems.
Right. Yep. Does anybody count on revenue to maintain your system? I'll buy a beer tonight. Well, I won't be here tonight, but I'll have Tim do it. If you can identify what that picture is, where it is. It's easy to identify what, but where it is.
Highway 5 on San Diego.
That's Ron Street. That is the toll booth in New Hampshire, driving up I-95. Now, let me tell you why this is important. When Maine is a... Anybody been to Maine? Yeah, if you haven't been there, put it on your list. Beautiful place. Just don't go in the winter. You got June through September. Colors, third week of September. That's it. Get out of it. But it's a place where it became kind of a vacation spot before air conditioning was invented. And, all the Rockefellers and all those kind of people all had places on the coast because the ocean gets up to 62 degrees in the summer. Okay? Your lips turn blue swimming. It's unbelievable. But it's wonderful in the summer, and it's a real, real place where people go on holidays. This toll booth is on the main pipe between New York, Boston, and Maine. You have to drive across 17 miles in New Hampshire and go through this toll booth and drop off your $2. Okay? And in my lifetime, again, I'm not that old. It was a quarter when I started. Actually, I had to write a check at that toll booth, believe it or not, because they didn't have a quarter. But they get their $2. There can be 10 miles of traffic stopped while they're waiting for their $2. The total cost to the economy is way greater than the money they're collecting. But they're thinking about their little environment. They're not thinking about the total enterprise of everybody on that highway. So we need to think in terms of what's best for the organization. I actually think we should pass a law that if you have more than a 3-minute wait in a toll booth, they have to open up the gates. And you get hit by free until they can manage the capacity. But you wait 20 minutes to get you $2. And the total cost is out of control. And that's really, that's one way to view how we deal with parcels, you know. You know, are we that $2? You know, are we servicing, you know, everybody who needs them? So this idea, I mentioned that the feds want them. This is how they want to get them. They want you to manage them. They roll up to a state coordinator. The state coordinator rolls them up to a federal coordinator, and then they're disseminated out. So the you'll see activity on this in the next coming years. And I guess if I had any recommendation at all, I would participate in the process to make sure that your interests are taken into concern, if they're taken or listened to. So parcels and green government, this is a big one. The carbon footprint stuff, that's pretty big. And also alternative energy. We know where the wind is. You know, we know where the geothermal is. We don't know necessarily where the properties are, and we don't know where the transmission grid is. So if we have to be able to bring these pieces together, and parcels play a key role in that as well. They're also good for controlling accuracy, and I'm going to step through this process in a few minutes. But they're the fundamental land element. Right? There's really, you know, there's other sub-elements, I guess, and when, you know, for those doing appraisal, you know, you've got the condo thing and, you know, and rental units, and there are subunits, but they're the fundamental unit of land, not necessarily property. They're created by measurements. Measurements come from surveyors. Those measurements come from instruments that we know a lot about the accuracy of the measurements. If we use those measurements in our workflows, we can improve the accuracy of the parcel network, parcel fabric, over time. And we can use that fabric, that parcel network, to maintain the accuracy of data in GIS. I'm going to spend a few minutes on that coming up. So but I want to talk about the importance of cadastre. That really is kind of the title of the talk, I think. So we talked about this idea of generating capital. You know, how do we get capital out of land? Well, once we create land markets, we can track the transactions. These markets mature. And we know we can create all kinds of creative financial instruments that we can trade. And we know what problems that gets us into if we get too creative. And that's really why we're in the shape we're in the mortgage crisis, because we lost the association of the paper to the property. It got blurred in all these creative financial instruments. The more you can keep that connection, and the economic term for that's called hidden information. You guys are trading these things that have ratings by somebody. You know, it's like, have you guys seen that Chevy commercial with Howie Long? And these two guys have that T-shirt that says they. Well, they rated these financial instruments this way. Well, who's they? So these things get traded. They get separated from the property. And the property loses value, these instruments lose value, and you can't even get back to the property they're associated with. So what is title? Title is it's a mythical thing. We really don't even have it in this country in a way, you know? Think of your car. You got the pink slip, right? You got the title for your car. Anybody got one of those for your house? They don't exist, okay? We have this thing where we get an opinion, you know, we're not really sure of the opinion, but we pay a lot for it, so we ensure that opinion, everybody agrees, you know, we all sing Kumbaya, we have title. And we all recognize it, nobody, you know, we all recognize that process is good, the authorities recognize it, and it creates a stable occupancy. It's really how it works. It's amazing that it's like one man, one vote. The only reason democracy works is we believe one man has one vote. Anytime you don't have that, you got the Mugabe thing going on, or you got, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan. You know, it's like you're not really sure. There's not faith in the democracy. Well, we kind of have that faith. And so the title works very much the same way. But there's elements of title. There's the who's. That's the people. And sometimes they have to pay attorneys for the who's. Then there's the rights, which is what can we do with the land? You know, what are the restrictions? And then there's what? Then there's the physical property. You jam all this together, and that's how, that's title. Now, in some parts of the world, we're blending the land registration systems with GIS. And does anybody here record property identification number when they record documents? Property documents? That's pretty forward thinking. Because that's going to give us the ability in the future to build a real technology-based cadastre. So we have these two pieces. We have the legal part, the paper, the deeds, the mortgages, all that kind of stuff. We record that. Then over here we have the parcel, we have the maps. And we record that, and we connect those with this parcel identification number. Anybody ever do deed research with a grantor grantee index? Well, it's awesome. Wouldn't it be nice to click on that parcel and have every document ever registered with that parcel come up and every adjoining parcel? Boom, just like that. Not hard to do. All we have to do is record that one piece of information at the time of recording. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a project we're doing in Ghana. We have several projects going on around the world. We have one in China that's pretty cool. With the unemployment happening in China, the guys are moving from the cities to the hinterlands. And land had, you know, back to where they're from 15 years ago, and land's been converted from farming to different uses, and there's a worry of starvation. So they want to get land locked into farming, assign those rights to people. And ownership means something different all around the world. You know, we have fee title here, fee, simple absolute, I guess, which is really nice. Most of the world has leasehold estates, but still, it's still viable if the leasehold is, you know, 40, 50 years or more. But there's also these sub-rights of just farming, to locking land and farming. So this project in Ghana, it's about 23 million people. Average per capita income is about $700 a year. All right? UN puts the poverty level at $2 per day. Pretty amazing. You know, anything less than that is poverty compared to the UN, anything above that's not extreme poverty. We're doing a project right outside the capital in this area called Ashiman. This is what it looks like. This is what the Ashiman district looks like. There's houses, there's concrete, cinder blocks. You can see a sewer, that white line, that's an open sewer. So there are improvements. You can see power lines in there, but there's absolutely no ownership of this land at all. So this is a little less structured, but you can still see, you know, there's utilities there. You know, there are buildings. But that's actually a really typical scene in Ghana right there. Somebody in incredibly colorful clothing with a whole bunch of stuff on their head. This is really pretty incredible. But it's a really entrepreneurial culture. It's a really safe place to go. You know, you can walk down the streets at night. There's no fear for your life. Begging is taboo. There are a few beggars, but not really many. Everybody's trying to do something. There's three women in here sewing clothes much like you would wear right now. Really, really fine stuff. And they get started in this by microfinance. Microfinance is lending small amounts of money, in this case $100 to a woman to buy a sewing machine. Literally in 2 weeks they're out of poverty. Okay? What we've done is coupled microfinance with title. The reason this is important is because $100 is cool. What if you want to be a fisherman and you need $15,000 for some nets and an outboard? Well, that's not really microfinance. That's a minimum. You need collateral, you need to be able to understand risk, you need some understanding of stability. So we've coupled title with microfinance, actually a paralegal title outside the legal system. So there's another, that's a bead shop, and I think the guy on the left is selling motor oil or something. We're very happy people, really optimistic place. It's not downtrodden, you know, it's not like the 1970, you know, 70s National Geographic, you see of Ethiopia kind of stuff. It's not really like that. So if you get a title now, these are actual pictures in their registry, and it's unbelievable, all right? I mean, they're one match away from a total disaster. It takes 6 months to get a provisional title. Their provisional title is, you go through the process, you get provisional title, sits there for 5 years, 10 years, then you can get full title if there's no claims and those are all sorted out. Much like the way we quiet a title, a very long process. not really used at all of the properties that we begin to work with. Everyone started the process, nobody completed, and some were into the process for 10 years. So, and on top of that, you have your land surveys, so you need a good description, between $300,000. Again, you know, we've been building these land registration systems around the world for 20 years, understanding that this is a key part to economies, but they missed the point. It's not about the survey, it's about the paper representing the property. You know, when land's worth $50 an acre, you don't need a $1,000 survey. It just doesn't make sense. So we developed this process of using micro title lending agents to go to the properties, fill out the paperwork, bring it back, so they don't have to do all the travel. You got to travel. We use some new technology here. So this is the process, what it looks like. We interview, we do a site survey, enter the data. 10 days, issue a paralegal title that the microfinance institutions will lend against. And then that is designed to mature into formal title. Much like getting a visa, you can go to the consulate, you can do it yourself. Or you can pay somebody $30 and they take care of all the heavy lifting for you. Or that $30 getting that visa in that batch process. So these are just some of the unique elements coupling with microfinance. This paralegal title is outside the government, although the government will recognize it as provisional title once it matures. And it's a centralized system. A couple of unique things, we're using the ESRI technology, of course. There's a partner who built stuff on top of ours, but we're integrating video and images into the title system. So you walk down a property line with your neighbor and you're holding your ID card and you kind of say, we agree this is the property line. Kind of removes disputes from that particular property. So we're leveraging all kind of new technology to make this happen. It's really kind of cool. You'll see a little bit about this in the days to come in ESRI Press. What happens, we also notice, is when you build a land registration system with GIS, you get a lot of other benefits that come with it for free. You want to do some urban planning, you want to try to site a health clinic, you want to look at illegal occupation. Well, maybe you don't want to title people who are living in flood zones, those kinds of things. So I'm going to totally shift gears now, because I told you I had combined three things here. I'm going to try to pull them all together here at the end. And I want to touch on accuracy, what that is. We all think of accuracy differently. There's really six types. Some can claim there's more. You can divide this into a wide variety. Topological accuracy, how things relate to each other, how they're connected. You know, maybe power lines. Does your meter go to this transformer, to this primary and secondary primary? Attributes, you know, this fire item. Do you have the installation date and then the manufacturer's name correct? Absolute spatial. If I go out there, WGS 84 with a GPS, am I going to find that fire hydrant? Or do I really care how close that fire hydrant is to the homes in this neighborhood for insurance purposes? So that's absolute and relative. Two different types of accuracy. How current is it? And then is it what we say? Is that really a manhole or is that a big oil spot on the pavement? These are all really important things when we start talking about leveraging the value out of GIS. So there's really three types of data in GIS. There's vectors, which we use every day, there's rasters, which we use every day, and there's survey data, which are really vector data with certain behaviors that we model very, very differently. Talked earlier about this idea of a model extracting things out of our head and the way we do our work and the uses of data. Well, we can model data on plans and the data in deeds as survey data and not just vector data and get a lot more information, a lot more value out of that data. Again, it's the attributes, it's the behavior and the geometry. These are different for survey data versus vector data. And when we build GIS, we base it on really one of three layers. It's either a parcel layer, transportation layer, ortho layer. Maybe it's based on nothing. Maybe it's just kind of, you know, what people just kind of sketched out over time. But most is built on the parcel layer. This parcel layer in GIS is critically important. I think there's seven layers described for critical importance for the National Spatial Data Infrastructure. And parcels is the one that have the least amount of information. But it's the most important. So there's really three tiers of parcel data management. There's ink on Mylar. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands on this if you're still doing this, all right? But then the next step was to scan and digitize those mylars, and then we got creative. We co-wrote in the dimensions and put them in some kind of system where we knew a little bit more about them. But we kind of had to fudge every parcel. Parcels will not fit together if you use all the dimensions and hold them firm. It's not good. Dimensions don't agree. You'll have two surveys of the same line have different dimensions, and that's okay. But you can't. You have to understand that and model that in the database properly. And then this new methodology, the survey-controlled parcel fabric. So think of parcels as a network of measurements. Okay. We know a lot about the measurements. We know which ones are good. We know which ones aren't any good. Right? And we can weight the good ones heavily, and the ones we don't think are very good, we can weight them lowly, and we can adjust them. Remember those football games when you were a kid? The table vibrated, you know, and you had that one guy, you had that felt football, and you set everything up, turned the table on, and you ran the play. Anybody remember those? Well, that's how least squares works. You know, if you let that table run a long time, it hits equilibrium. Well, if you put into the parcel fabric the dimensions and what you know about them, and do a least squares adjustment, it will hit equilibrium. So least squares, it just means minimizes the sums of the squares and residuals. So you move everything the least amount based on the confidence you have in that measurement. So you can build this measurement network, this parcel fabric, out of parcels and adjust it. Now here's the problem. So let's say we do that. In this diagram, we see how we've adjusted those parcels. We fixed them to the geodetic control. But that Smith road down there, that information we have associated with the parcel fabric doesn't fit. Right? It doesn't fit now because we just adjusted the parcels to what we consider to be the best mathematical representation. But we can store the displacements of all the corner points of the parcels in the geodatabase and use those as parameters to adjust any other feature layer that you want to adjust. So we begin, just as we think of survey control managing parcels, we can use parcels to manage the control, all the data in GIS. And this is just an example of an ortho before and after least squares adjustment done on an ortho. And if you guys get new orthos and your parcels don't fit, which, you know, maybe they do, maybe they don't, maybe you're up to date, maybe you're not. If they don't fit, this is not a bad workflow to take a look at. So we take a survey, parcels, connect it to the geodetic network, and we use that to manage the data in GIS, the accuracy. Now what happens is this works as part of, it's not like you're going to do this overnight. You build this into your workflow, and you adjust incrementally over time. So you know how you get a new survey and it doesn't fit, and you kind of warp the survey to fit into your system? That's backwards. I mean, that's the old one. Because the survey is good, and you want things around it to fit into it, and that's what this does. It kind of holds what you know to be good and adjusts the things that really aren't as good around it. So hopefully this will help keep surveyors from going nuts when we talk about GIS. So it's a new data set. I'm running short on time here, so I'm going to speed up a little bit. It's very simple, you know. There's plans. Parcels are part of plans. There's points and lines. That's really about it. There's two kinds of points. There's control points and line points. Now, I'm going to skip that one, but I want to talk about this line point thing. Because, you know, we talked about modeling and how we model what we know in our head. Well, you know, when you have a long section line, that's a straight line. Right? The property abuts up to that line. If you were to build this parcel network and have a node at each one of those points along that line and adjust it, that line would be broken. It would not be a straight line. So we've created a new topological feature, a new thing called a line point, where that line is fixed, and you can see point number 32 terminates on that line, but it's not part of that line. So it's actually from a programmatic standpoint, from a mathematics standpoint, it's just incredibly complicated. But we know it has to happen because we don't want to be breaking lines that are senior that don't need to be broken. So the goal of doing this is to build a very simple system, you know, to represent parcels the best we can. You know, we're never going to build fences from parcel maps, I hope. Has anybody built a fence parcel maps? I hope not. But what we're trying to do is get the best mathematical representation using the best information we have, which is the survey record. So to take a look at this in a different light, we maintain all the history of the parcel. It's not like things change. The record dimension is a record dimension and never changes. We adjust it for a graphical representation, and we can have five record dimensions of the same line. And we weight them, and we adjust them. Those all remain the same. It's just how we represent them in our GIS. So we preserve the record and the history of the record, and then we update the positional representation or the geometry with least squares adjustments. So we want to best represent land information in GIS. We want precise coordinates. We want to build a system that as we do our work, we incrementally improve things. We can't afford to go out and remap. You know, in 10 years, orthos are going to be good to a half an inch, all right? They're not going to fit your work, and you're not going to be able to remap all your parcels. But in your daily work, you can build a workflow that helps parcels keep up with everything else. Now, just a couple minutes on what's happening in the future here, and then I'll close, and hopefully maybe we'll have time for a question or two. When we talk about GIS, just to summarize, you know, we're talking about really different pieces of the environment here. We're not talking about just a server. We're not talking about desktop. We're talking about a combination of all those, and they're driven by this enterprise bus. This bus publishes and receives information through the geodatabase, which is the technology that manages anything with a spatial component, whether you're routing an emergency vehicle or whether you're mapping a parcel. You're seeing some of these now, whether you know it or not, a lot of these new applications online. And I want to talk a little bit about this, because this is something very, very new that's happening with the internet. Instead of just using software and having your data is available to you, and you don't have to buy. Just like inside your organization, you publish parcels for the whole organization to use, there's data published nationwide that you can consume and use through connecting through web services. Web services is really just connecting to some data that acts like it's on your desktop and you use it, but you don't really even have to download it, just connect to it. So there's all this data that's coming available. Much like in MapQuest or any of those where you change from a street view to a satellite view, you get all that data is available for use via the internet. We've talked a bit about that demographic data. That's also coming to you. So a couple thoughts here that I'd like to leave you with. This is kind of the summary. You may need to maintain data in the future differently than the past, because as we eliminate the silos, as we eliminate the roadblocks for cooperation, the data that other people use that you have, they may need something different with it. They may take charge of that data, you may take charge of that data, there may be a cooperative effort, but the way you maintain data now is going to change, I'm pretty sure of that. We're depending on data in big systems. We're making business critical decisions. In some cases, we're making life and death decisions. There are cases where the ambulance went to the interstate, and there was no cross. There was no way across the interstate, but that's where the routing took them. So we're making life and death decisions with GIS. So the data that's in there needs to be good, and we all need to participate in that. These dependencies are going to evolve. There's no going back. This isn't a trend. When you study in textbooks, you see these things come and go. Well, I don't think the internet's going to go away. I don't think the accumulation of data is going to go away. And I don't think the dependency on automated systems is going to decrease. So we need to consider that, as we do our daily work. And parcels, these are really, they're really key to a lot of things, whether you think so or not. Worldwide, they're a fundamental key to unlocking some of the problems of poverty, at least we hope so. We'll know in a few years on some of the work we're doing. It's a framework for accuracy. It adds so much intelligence to a map. If you have imagery, that's great, put parcels over that, and it really adds so much depth and understanding to the map. So that's That's what I have. I got a few minutes for questions, I think, if anybody has any questions.
What about the east door adjustment? Do you have a limit for area or?
There is a limit, and I think we ran 800,000 points, and you're going to push the limit there. But really, you only need to think about the limits of where your geodetic control is. So you're going to adjust between control, and unlike a pure least squares, we don't adjust the control at all. Control remains fixed. If it's surveyed, it's surveyed. It's fixed. So then you can just adjust within those, that control limit.
Any questions beginning about inside the
I think we have business partners back there. And Amadea, raise your hand, Amadea. She is like, I'm glad she showed up because she's going to handle all the tough questions. And she'll be around here all day today, and she's doing some work tomorrow as well. So she'll be able to help you out with that for sure. Anything else? All right, well, thanks a lot.
I have one more question.
Darn.
You said you were a surveyor?
Yes.
Will surveyors have any problems with when the assessor starts adjusting their work with these squares?
See, now, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
If you're smart, you're going to weight the survey work really heavily. But you're not adjusting their work. You're adjusting all the information to get the best representation of parcels. Surveyors will kind of have, they may become concerned and say, well, I'm using least squares, which is a huge survey methodology, and you're beginning to think like surveyors think of managing data the way they would. I think we're trying to get them involved. They could provide some real value in this area for us. So.
Well, in California, they picked them a little bit more fast, and they were trying to get this legislation passed through, I guess, where surveyors would have to oversee the assessor's drafting process. So it's kind of a sore subject.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I speak to surveyors all the time, and what I try to speak to them is lead, not legislate. There's a lot of work to be done here. There aren't enough people to do it, and they can have access to plenty of work without legislating the ability to. No surveyor snuck in the room when I was talking today. Any other questions? All right. Thanks.